Hello, and welcome to Church in Maine, the podcast at the intersection of faith and modern life. I am Dennis Sanders, your host. Church in Maine is a podcast that looks for God in the midst of the issues that are affecting the church and the larger society. Now, you can learn more about the podcast, listen to past episodes, and donate by checking us out at churchinmaine.org or churchinmaine.substack.com. Consider subscribing to the podcast. You can do that at either website or on your favorite podcast app, and leave a review. That does help others find this podcast. So I have another best of episode, which is quite common this time of year when people are scarce for interviews. And this one feels somewhat timely again. This is an interview I did in December 2021 with Drew McIntyre, who is a Methodist elder, Methodist pastor at a church in Greensboro, North Carolina. And he wrote an article for Firebrand magazine on Black Lives Matter. And that has always been, unfortunately, a very controversial topic. For some people, it is kind of the kind of vanguard of a movement. For others, it just seems like what would be considered reverse racism. But Drew is looking at this from a theological standpoint. And the article that he wrote, which is The Scandal of Particularity, Black Lives and Jesus in 2021, was a thought-provoking article. I thought that I would share it again. And, you know, the whole movement of Black Lives Matter sometimes can be how it has gone down. Sometimes has not been very helpful, I think, to racial reconciliation, racial justice. But that doesn't mean that the phrase doesn't have some theological significance. I think sometimes some important theological significance. And so I wanted to share this article again, and also this interview I had with Drew again. And so I hope that you will listen. And as he says towards the end of the interview, let him know what you think. You can find out. He'd like to know. He'd like to learn from others and hear from others. And I will put contact information, especially to his website, on the show notes. One note again, you will hear the word, the podcast being referred to as En Route. En Route, of course, it was the prior name for the podcast before it became Church in Maine. So just so that you know that that's when you hear that and wondering where in the world, what in the world is this whole En Route all about? That's what it's all about. We will have another special episode coming up. It won't be an interview episode, but just before Christmas. And I'm still kind of working out some things for a recap episode for some of the noteworthy interviews I had in 2023, what I'm looking at coming forward in 2024. And so I'll talk about the year in the past. It's been kind of a big year in my life personally. There've also been some really good interviews. So, stay tuned for that episode, which, hopefully will come next week. But for now, let's listen to this 2021 interview I had, with, Drew McIntyre. Faith and Modern Life. I am Dennis Sanders, your host. Welcome. This is the podcast where we explore the who, where, what, why, and how of religion and the intersections with other aspects of life. Black Lives Matter. Those three words have launched a million arguments over the last 8 years or so. What began as a hashtag in the wake of the acquittal of George Zimmerman concerning the death of Trayvon Martin has become a phrase that has gone global. And all the while, it has become controversial. Some think that it's an exclusive term, maybe even racist, because they think that it only focuses on Black people. Others are suspicious because of the organization that also bears that name, that takes incredibly far-left positions on various issues. But there are others that like the phrase, but they seem to take it on without really asking any questions. Methodist pastor Drew McIntyre wanted to look at Black Lives Matter from a theological standpoint. What does it mean for followers of Jesus to say this phrase? Can followers of Jesus say this phrase? The answer is an emphatic yes. And in this episode, we will talk about what Black Lives Matter means from a theological viewpoint, and what it means for African Americans to hear the church say Black Lives Matter. Join us for the journey this week. Drew is a pastor of Grace United Methodist Church in Greensboro, North Carolina. I have known him for several years, and I always appreciate what he has to say because he moves from the surface level to really dig deep into theological issues that far too many of us really don't want to deal with. So I hope that you will enjoy this conversation. With that, let's listen to Drew. Good to talk to you.
You too, Dennis. Thank you for having me.
Well, for those people who are definitely kind of in the TLDR camp, would you be able to kind of give a summary of the article and kind of go from there?
Sure, sure. You know, as a preacher, I'm used to people telling me I ran too long, so I'm used to that. I guess if I'd start by saying sort of what I wanted to do with this piece, and what I wanted to do with this piece really was just bring some theology to the conversation around Black Lives Matter. And not Black Lives Matter, sort of the social movement or the hashtag or the organization, but really just the concept of Black Lives Matter. What does it mean to bring some kind of Christian theology to that? Because I don't know what your experience has been, but what I've observed since it's been around is sort of, we have some folks that sort of immediately appropriate that language, sort of uncritically in my view, mm-hmm. and talking about the church primarily, and others who dismiss it, I think, equally uncritically, just sort of react. And so I really wanted to ask in this piece, sort of, what does it mean to examine this theologically? And how I got to that was, this just sort of hit me one day, that the way people were reacting to Black Lives Matter was very much like what Newbegin wrote about when he described his scandal of particularity. Mm-hmm. Newbegin, are you a Newbegin fan? Have you read any of Newbegin stuff?
I have read some of Newbegin stuff.
Yeah, I'm a big Newbegin fan. I encountered him in seminary. One of my professors, Jeffrey Wainwright, was close to Newbegin. Newbegin was a missiologist and an ecumenist. Wrote some really amazing books. Was later a bishop, I think, in the Unified Church of India. Mm. But he had this concept called a scandal of particularity, that it's a scandal to the modern mind that God works through particulars, through particularity of Israel as a people, not as a nation state. Want to bracket, you know, again, bracket that from the conversation, but the biblical people of God, and also that God works particularly in and through Jesus as the, you know, as the Word made flesh, as the incarnate Savior. That there's something that grates in the modern mind that kind of grates against that. And in a similar way, there's something, I think, at least in American culture, that grates against this notion that that there should be or would be an emphasis on the importance of Black lives in the midst of too many unnecessary deaths and killings, and of course all the other things we've seen the last decade or so. And so it was making the connection anew again is kind of how I started. And then I sort of built onto that some insights from the new perspective on Paul, which has really done important work, especially following E.P. Sanders in biblical studies, reassessing the connections between Judaism and the New Testament, and sort of getting away from some of the overly medieval kind of anti-Catholic stuff that led to some really harsh readings of Judaism and the New Testament. A lot of that came from one of my professors in seminary, Douglas Campbell, was a big influence on me. And then also I looked at John Wesley. I'm a United Methodist pastor, and of course I've got to go to John Wesley. But you know, the last letter we have from John Wesley was a letter to William Wilberforce, who of course was an evangelical Christian that was fighting against slavery in Britain. And in his letter, Wesley describes American slavery as the most vile form that the earth had ever seen, you know, that the world had ever known. And so I kind of put all that together, along with some personal kind of anecdotes, just as a way of saying, you know, in the biblical narrative, the biblical drama, God works oftentimes from the particular to the whole. We like to work from the whole to the particular, but God works from the particular to the whole. And that might give us some, I think, some scriptural warrants for the church right now to say, you know, it's, and a lot of this we've seen in sort of memes and social media posts, but just this idea that, like, you know, if I'm the fire department and there's a house on fire, what's important in that moment is not that every house matters. What's important in that moment is that there's a house on fire. And I think this is a way of theologically of saying, you know, these are the people that are feeling devalued right now, whose lives are endangered, who feel devalued by the culture writ large. And the church should be able to say, I close by saying, we shouldn't be surprised that people cannot hear us saying, all people matter to Jesus, unless we first say Black lives matter to Jesus. So I hope that's a helpful summary. I'm curious if you think that's what you read in the piece, but
yeah, that is exactly what I read. And I think it is, there's a lot of truth in that I think our modern way of looking at things is from a very universal standpoint. And I think that there are lots of things, especially in our particular faith, that because it's runs the other way. And I think we have a hard time dealing with things that aren't universal, because I tend to think that we have a bias against the particular, that the particular we somehow think it means exclusive, right? Or so there's that kind of tension. So that it seems like that's part of the reason, at least from my standpoint, where Black Lives Matter can be grating, because it makes it sound like that's the only group that matters. Anyone that knows I guess I would think that people who are at least aware know that this is not some type of Black separatism. This is something really about looking at a particular part of humanity, but it's not excluding. It's kind of like the whole thing of Jesus, or the parable of going after the one sheep and leaving the 99 behind. Does that mean that the shepherd doesn't care about the 99? No, he does. But there is this one sheep that's out there that needs help. And I would think that that's kind of how you would at least look at Black Lives Matter, especially from a Christian standpoint.
Yeah. And you know, again, I think I say this in the piece. I'm a United Methodist pastor. That doesn't mean I can endorse everything that's got a UMC stamp on it. And in the same way, I think Christians should be able to say, at least understand why we need to say Black Lives Matter without having to defend everything that's had Black Lives Matter on it. right? We should be able to kind of be mature enough to kind of bracket those things. It's also, an important part of my piece is the work of Willie James Jennings. Dr. Jennings used to be at Duke. He's at Yale now, but I think a really important thinker right now for the church. He had a really great interview that was in Christianity Today that I drew on for this piece, where he talks, he really makes those connections about kind of the origins of racism being in sort of the de-Judaizing of Christianity. And I drew on that pretty heavily. He also talks in there about sort of Christians, Christian anxiety about not being the center of the story, right? That we de-Judaize Christianity because we want to be the center of the story. And so it's also worth naming, as I say in the piece, that I have a degree of awkwardness about this piece and about talking about it because I recognize I'm in danger of centering myself in a conversation that's not about me, and in danger of putting, you know, I don't know, my voice in the middle of a conversation where other voices, frankly, are more valuable than mine. I first drafted this piece about 6 months ago. And kind of sat on it for a long time, had friends look at it, you know, left it alone for a while, went back to it. I was very hesitant about putting this out there just because I wanted it to be as good as it could be. But also I don't know, we're both mainline pastors. I won't speak for you, but I feel like I know a lot of progressive young clergy that want to sort of wear the mantle of fighting racism and make that a big part of their identity. And to me, in some ways, that's often kind of an obvious, attempt at platforming themselves. And I really don't want to be that. And so I was hesitant in some ways about this piece. It's not kind of racism, race matters is not something I've often written about. Not because I'm not interested. I try to read very widely and pay attention. But again, just because I feel kind of inadequate talking about it and, you know, having an opinion about it, frankly, in some ways. So I'm grateful for the chance to talk to you about it and just kind of get your thoughts. Because again, I feel like I got something to say, but also I feel like I'm just another white guy saying too much in some ways. So.
But, you know, I think that part of it is important. And I can understand the concern about ending up centering yourself in that. I don't think that's what's happening here. I think it's actually, in some ways, and I know this word gets used way too much and usually doesn't mean what people think it means, but I do think that this was in some ways prophetic in that it's trying to speak maybe a difficult word that to help people understand what is the importance of this phrase theologically. And that can be, I think, disconcerting to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. If there are people who've, I think, immediately appropriated the word and just kind of go from there, there's probably a sense that, you know, as I think you wrote, that you're not going far enough. And then there are those that, hearing the phrase just kind of raises hackles and they just get freaked out and they need to hear this because even if they don't necessarily want to hear it or maybe try not to hear it, but you know, there is an importance of what does this mean? And especially about who is the gospel for? And ultimately the gospel is for everyone. But I also think that there's a part of it, and I think you use this in the article to borrow kind of from our Catholic sisters and brothers, that there is this whole preferential option for the poor, that this sense that the marginalized are kind of important in God's eyes. Again, not saying that no one else is, but that these people hold some special value. And, you know, I think that that matters. And I think the whole point of, I guess, again, putting Jews in the center of that story of salvation
also matters. Because kind of the whole religion kind of doesn't work if you don't have the Jews in there somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. It just doesn't really work that well without them. So.
Yeah, well, and I mean, Paul's, you know, people meet up on Paul, that's a separate podcast, but Paul's very, you know, very clear about this, that, you know, and this is in the piece, that we are a wild Gentiles or a wild olive branch, right? We have been graciously included in a story that was not ours, right? Through the work of Christ, the blessings and covenant of Israel are opened up to us. And when we forget that, it gets very ugly. And at the risk of, you know, every internet conversation devolving into talking about Nazis, there is historically a connection to Christians forgetting about the Jewishness of Jesus and the Jewishness of Christianity, making possible, you know, the final solution. That's a real historical thing. That's not just hyperbole. That's not rhetoric. That's real history.
Pretty much all you have to do is read the Barman Declaration, and that will tell you. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. So bad stuff happens when many bad things happen when Gentiles, Christians forget that the story does not center on us, that we have been invited to a table that, you know, was not ours originally, which is a scandal, but it's also true.
Yeah, I think. One of the things I remember in my first year in seminary, we had a spent basically a Saturday at a local synagogue and met with the rabbi of that congregation. And there's something I remember him talking about in referencing Isaiah and kind of referencing what a certain passage, how, you know, we would interpret it as usually referencing Christ. And, you know, he was trying to say how they look at it. And the thing that I remember him saying is the importance that, you know, it's fine to interpret it that way. Don't, you know, don't not do that, but just remember where this came from and the importance of where it came from. And that's something that's has stuck with me all these years later, is that how I'm looking at that. And let's say if I'm looking at a certain part of Isaiah that we think is referencing, talking about Jesus, it's important. And I'm not going to not look at it that way. But not everyone, the original people who wrote this, didn't see it that way. And that's important to know.
Yeah, maybe this is some of the wisdom of more liturgical traditions that always include Old Testament and or Psalm readings, you know, in worship, that we can't just live in the Gospels and the letters, you know, all the time.
Yeah. So what led you to actually kind of take this on? Was there some event, something that you had been seeing that made you feel like you needed to try to kind of look at what this phrase meant in a theological focus?
I think, you know, maybe it was just, I think maybe getting tired of sort of the typical internet back and forth of Black Lives Matter, and then someone responds, All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter. I think that sort of kind of hackneyed back and forth in some ways was annoying to me. But also, I did kind of want to challenge in some ways both sides in this for the church, because I really had not seen any what I would consider very substantive theological engagement with this idea. You know, the most you'd see that I'd seen anyway is sort of a easily imagined kind of liberationist, you know, view on this, which is fine. That's not going to convince everyone. That's going to work well with mainline clergy. It's not going to work great with people in most rural pews. It's not enough. And I think there's just a richer case to be made. And that's what I wanted to try to do, to really think through this theologically, bracketing sort of the ideological stuff, because that's just noise. And I think most of the response to this has been a lot of noise in terms of it not being very thoughtful. And so I wanted to offer kind of a thoughtful analysis of this. I thought I would get, frankly, more pushback from both sides. I didn't get as much pushback as I thought I would on this piece. I got mostly positive comments. I got, you know, a few of the sort of expected, like, no, all lives matter kind of pushback on this. But yeah, most folks, and I did, you know, I had friends read this, and I will say where I landed on this was a little bit of a stronger statement than where I kind of drafted it to start. I had friends that read it who said, this is good. I think you could push it a little bit more. And I did where it ended up. I pushed a little bit more than where initially I had it. But I don't know. I like writing because it forces me to think, and it was enjoyable to think through this in what hopefully is a robust theological way.
So one of the questions that this article has brought up in me is, why do you think there has been a push in some ways to de-Judaize the story and to put Christians in the center of the story instead of realizing that we're guests basically in someone else's house?
Yeah, I think part of it is just historical ignorance and forgetfulness. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is a lot of people raised in churches that only ever preach out of the New Testament. And so people just don't know, you know. If you ever teach, you know, a Bible study on the book of Revelation, something like, I can't remember the exact statistic, but something like 2/3 of the passages in Revelation are either a direct or indirect allusion to something in the old, mm-hmm. right? So, I always tell people, like, you really can't understand the New Testament unless you have some grasp of the Old Testament. But at least in my experience, most Christians have very little grasp of the Old Testament. So I think that's a part of it. And there is certainly the whole sort of Protestant background of readings of Paul in particular of the New Testament that were overly shaped by debates about medieval Catholicism, you know, coming out of Luther and all that. And so I think Protestantism, a lot of this is the underside of anti-Catholicism among Protestants. Because Luther read all the stuff about the law in the New Testament as being about the Catholic Church that he was rebelling against or trying to reform, whatever. Which is all good and well 500 years ago, but it gets sort of applied, I think. I think Luther was too shaped by his experience of the Catholic Church, and in turn, Protestants have been too shaped by that misreading of Luther's, which is a lot of what the sort of new perspective on Paul is kind of trying to correct. But I think we've inherited too much of that anti-quote-unquote religion, which is anti-Catholic, which ultimately is anti-Jewish. I think that's sort of where it comes from. And combined with a sort of American, I don't know, populism or something, that everything is about the individual and the idea of anything having to do with community or something like Israel versus like, no, salvation is about my individual choices. I think the idea that we're caught up in this larger story is very difficult for a lot of, again, American Protestants, especially of a more sort of fundamentalist, radical individualist kind of variety. Does any of that make sense? Does that track with
you? Yeah, I think that...
I know I just word vomited a lot right there.
I think that makes some sense. There is something, especially in American society, and in certain sectors of American society, that is very much focused on the individual. And I always like to say that there's nothing necessarily wrong about the individual, but it's kind of like salt. If it's too much of it, it can be a bad thing. And so that there's this concern that anything that kind of is communal, it's like, well, obviously this is socialism. And it's kind of like, no, it's not. Right. And I think that that's, you know, the Bible, I think, is especially in the Old Testament, but I think in the New Testament, is really rife and looking at things from a societal level in a way that I think is hard for us to, at least in the West, to understand. I think sometimes in other parts of the world, they might understand it more because they have a very different understanding of individuals and society and all that. But yeah, here, that's always been hard.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I fully agree. I mean, I got a lot of, I guess, my sort of, I don't know, and I feel differently about, yeah, I echo you, and I think an individual is very important. I mean, I'm a, you know, free speech and, mm-hmm. and all those sort of classic, you know, kind of classic constitutional values, I think are very important, and individual conscience and all those things. I think, though, when we bring that into the church and we become allergic to anything that is outside of myself or larger than myself, that's where it becomes a problem. Because, as you point out, the Bible, both the Old Testament and New Testament, are both largely written by, to, and for communities, right? Whether that community is Israel, whether that community is the church. It is communities that produce the documents that became our Bible, and they're largely written to be read and lived in community. And I think we miss that to our peril. Yes, it's important to have personal discipleship, but you have to have your own relationship with God. That's, you know, never take that away. But it's also meant to be a journey that we do together. And there's a reason that Jesus, the first thing he does is gather 12 disciples, mm-hmm. right? We're meant to do this thing together.
I agree. There are several things here that are always fascinating, but towards the end of the essay, you recount a story from graduate school with a pastor, and mm-hmm. he basically says, and this is quote, "Don't tell me what you believe about Jesus. Tell me about tell me how you feel about Black people, and then I will tell you everything I need to know about what you believe about Jesus."
Yeah.
I find that a fascinating statement. And what do you think he meant by that? And how did you take that when you first heard it?
It definitely, you know, it struck me, obviously, because I remembered it. You know, this is more than 10 years ago. This is, gosh, over 13 years ago. It definitely stuck with me. And at the time, I think I said this in the piece, I was taken aback by it initially, very much because of the scandal of particularity. Like, wait a minute, what do you mean? But the context of that, and I didn't have space to this in the article to explain this, but the context for him saying that was, I'm pretty sure, it was a conversation just about, talk about scandal, this whole notion that, you know, people who consider themselves Orthodox Christians, who communed every Sunday, who baptized their kids, who, you know, chanted the Psalms, whatever it was, people that went to church every Sunday, gave to their local churches, who also at the same time either owned slaves or underwrote Jim Crow or had a Klan robe in the closet, right? That whole notion that for wide swaths of American Christianity and beyond America, there are millions, if not billions, of Christians who did not connect their faith to how Black people were treated, right? He was naming that sort of dissonance and saying, and I think what he was trying to say was, lots of people say they love Jesus and want to know about their orthodoxy, but these people who are saying that the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed every week are also beating their slaves on the way home from church, right? And I think he was kind of naming that. But just the way he said it, I thought was very powerful. And it stuck with me. And it's, again, this idea of, it's Matthew 25, right? As much as you did it to the least of these, you did it unto me. So there's a real way in which if my faith in Christ, my following, you know, the poor Jewish Jesus is not leading me to at least care in some way about the marginalized, the oppressed, in particular in this conversation, what's happening with African Americans in the US and the legal system in particular, then I've missed something significant about Jesus. I it was funny to recall that story. That was a very formative class for me. That was a fun class. He was an African American Presbyterian pastor who also kind of taught in seminary on the side. And he was very, I mean, especially for me at that point, he was very radical compared to where my politics were at that point in my life. And, you know, he would walk into class and say, I'm a socialist. I'm, all these things. I was like, whoa. But I learned a great deal from him. And that was just one of those pieces. Yeah.
So what do you think can be the implications of basically theologically saying Black Lives Matter? What does that mean for a person? What does that mean for a church if they take that and not just say it because everyone else is saying it, but say it in a way that they've thought about it and what it means for followers of Jesus Christ to say this?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think it needs to be more than, there's nothing wrong with having a sign in someone's yard. That's not really my thing. Did you ever watch Seinfeld? Were you a Seinfeld fan at all? The episode where Seinfeld doesn't want to wear the ribbon. I don't want to wear the ribbon. I'm one of those people. Like, I don't want the sign. I don't want the slogan. That's kind of my personality. I'm an Enneagram 4, so I am an individualist in that sense. I do think, for me, what this should affect is kind of the posture of the church. How do we engage with our neighbors? So for instance, my ministry context, I'm in a downtown congregation. Until the pandemic, we've often had all sorts of ministries to kind of the downtown community, which in my context is heavily African-American. So what does it mean for us to be neighbors to folks who are experiencing these incidents with police? Who are seeing these stories on the news. I have African-American, have had African-American staff members. And what does it mean for me as a pastor and as a supervisor to walk with empathy through these things when these stories are in the news and all that? And I don't know that I've done any of that. I definitely haven't done any of it perfectly. I hope I've stumbled and done it okay and tried to, without making it about my feelings and my need to be the good white guy. I hope I've, because of thinking through things like this, been able just to be sensitive and to listen in a lot of ways. I think that's a big part of it. Because again, I said this at the beginning, but especially with, gosh, a lot of mainline clergy, it just seems like coming from a good place and unintentionally, it often becomes about, the young white person that needs to be seen as the radical or the prophet. I don't think that's the answer. There's a name I'm not going to say, but there are people that literally built their platforms on doing this. Maybe a better example is, because of taking things like this seriously, what it looks like is me texting a friend when one of these horrible things hits the news and just saying to an African-American friend, hey, I don't have anything meaningful to say, but I'm praying for you today. I'm sure this is hard to watch. I can't imagine what you're going through. And I just want you to know that I value you. And I'm sorry that you have to see this and experience this. Maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, I think that one of the, it's interesting being African American I have a reticence sometimes to talk about race in the church, not because I don't want to, but I think because it hasn't been done well. I think that there has been a lot of a center of kind of look at me type of attitude sometimes, or in a way of kind of guilting people that isn't really healthy, and it doesn't really cause people to really think. I think what it does is that it causes people to react. And so I think one of the things that I long for and want is better ways to talk about this issue, because it needs to be talked about. And I think that there still are a lot of people that, you know, if we go back to looking at the phrase Black Lives Matter, don't really understand it from a theological standpoint, and I think need to hear another viewpoint. But I think the way that especially a lot of mainline clergy handle it is not, doesn't work. And I think it doesn't further the discussion or even further bringing a, you know, down the road towards racial reconciliation.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I agree with that. And I, you know, I think this is a both, we could pick on the mainline and also pick on kind of evangelicals. I think in part, this is because both, for me, a lot of at least clergy and lay people in both the mainline and evangelicals and Protestantism are so formed by sort of what used to be cable news. Now, I guess it's podcasts and YouTube.
Podcasts, yeah, YouTube, you know, everything.
But, you know, talking heads, right? Mm-hmm. Ideological talking heads on whichever side, you know, you can name all the whoever's. So much of it, we are much more shaped by that sort of those talking heads, those ideological voices, than anything biblical or theological. I think that's where a lot of, and I would say, I'm mainline, I think I'd say this, a lot of our clergy are educated in institutions that in some ways emphasize the ideological, the sociological, more than the theological. I mean, frankly, a lot of at least Methodist seminaries, the theology is pretty weak. You know, one way of understanding the mainline is you can believe anything you want theologically, but you better believe these things politically.
Yep.
They're very, very open-minded when it comes to who Jesus is. Very close-minded when it comes to what your politics should be. And that starts in the seminaries in some ways. But also, again, there's certainly plenty on the right, just sort of this sort of knee-jerk reaction to anything like a decent conversation about race and racism in America, very sort of dismissive and defensive, right? A lot of it is, I got a few responses like this to my piece, just sort of what sounded like kind of just defensive old white dudes, honestly. I hate to put it that way. Yeah.
Why do you think that there can be defensiveness? Because I think you see that happening in a lot of different places. I read a lot of writings by David French. And I think he wrote something, this was maybe back in the summer, that talked about racism and the importance of really coming to terms of things. And he got just a lot of vitriol from it.
Mm.
And what is it about even just having, not even just saying Black Lives Matter, but even just talking about issues that, you know, racial issues that are still a problem, that people get immediately defensive? Are they, is it that they're looking at this from an individual standpoint and thinking that it's blaming them, or what's going on?
Yeah, I think there's some of that. I mean, I think, you know, I've definitely had, when I was younger, conversations or listen to a lecture or whatever about racism or something in racial kind of history, where I feel implicated, right? Where there is this sort of that sort of personalized thing. I think there's a lot of I don't know, a lot of fear of that conversation, a lot of, you know, one of the things I say this, to this in sermons and in classes, one of sort of the mythologies of the South, Stanley Hauerwas talks about this in some places. One of the kind of the mythologies of growing up in the South is, of course, related to, you know, the Civil War was fought over states' rights, right? Yeah, another big one is you never meet anyone in the South whose family owned slaves, right? It's just a kind of a trope in conversation, but I can remember these conversations growing up.
It all just vanished.
Right? Yeah, like, well, yes, you know, slavery was wrong and slavery was a problem, but our family wasn't involved in that. We were poor white people, right? So I that defensiveness, I definitely recall a lot hearing growing up. I don't know if you find that as much in, you know, 20-somethings now, but I certainly remember hearing that stuff growing up. I think, yeah, it's hard to say. I think it's multifaceted and it's different for different people. I mean, there is a, how do I say? Well, I think I already said this, right? I had some trepidation about writing this piece and publishing it in part just because it's about race, and the conversation in a lot of places is pretty toxic. On both the left and the right, where if you veer from whatever the orthodox position is, you're going to be vilified very, very openly. So I think in some ways, at least online, that conversation is pretty toxic. I think it's unfortunate. And maybe what I should say is I think a better answer is relation. I think the best context for this conversation is relationships. Right. Like I've learned, you know, I try to read a lot of books and stuff like that, taking classes, but you know, it was one of the most, again, formative things for me was one of my district superintendents, I want to say this was maybe shortly after the Trayvon Martin case or when that was still kind of pending. So this would have been close to 10 years ago. I think the timing's right. I don't know. But my African-American district superintendent, which in Methodist church is sort of kind of like a mini bishop, right? Kind of my immediate boss and the bishop is all of our bosses in our polity. Our DS, who's African-American, describing the conversations that he had to have with his children when they were growing up about how to deal with police, right? And I remember that moment, like I never heard a Black person describe that conversation before. That was new to me, right? And that was in my mid-20s probably at that point. I mean, that was a new concept to me. And so just in the context of that relationship, someone I trusted and looked up to saying, look, I'm not that old, but I had to have this conversation with my teenage son. You know, that was huge for me. And that's not a talking head. That's not a bullet point. That's not an article. It's not a blog post. It's not a tweet. That's a person I knew and loved and trusted saying, this is what it's like for me and my family in North Carolina in 2011, whatever it was, you know. When some of the pushback I got on this piece was like, this is not practical. What do you do with this? And one response to that is something I think churches can and should do is have partnerships between predominantly Anglo, predominantly African-American churches. And there's a friend of mine in town who's a Methodist pastor who's African-American. And we began kind of a process of like, this was a few years ago before the pandemic, we would get lunch once a month or so, you know, have a burger and just kind of talk and catch up. And most of what we did was not really talk about social stuff or even church stuff. We're both nerds and we talk about Marvel movies and comic books and that kind of stuff, but just sort of bonding on a human level. And we began to talk about, hey, we should get our churches together. What would that look like? How can we, you know, should we do a Bible study together? Should we have potlucks together? We were in the process of starting that and kind of the pandemic happened. But I think that's sort of, for the church, a great place to start stuff like this is just building local relationships. I mean, I'm in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is in some ways, you know, a hotbed of the civil rights movement in the 50s, the Sit-In movement, stuff like that. I mean, my church is walking distance to the International Civil Rights Museum. So we should be able, in my context, to have this conversation. And again, posture, right? To be able to go to our neighboring African American church and saying, you know, we want to have a relationship. We want to learn from one another. We know that there's stuff that we don't understand. We want to and just kind of build a relationship in Christ as brothers and sisters, but also try to learn, you know, from one another what it's like to be you in this time and place and hear your stories. I would say for me, that's been most significant is those personal relationships. A good friend of mine who is an African-American Baptist pastor that I was a Duke with, you know, he's at the risk of the trope of my Black friend, let me name that, right? I get that's a trope. But it's been hugely important for me to sort of have those conversations and ask him questions I'm not going to ask other African-American people that I know through the course of the last 5 to 10 years when these things are in the news and stuff like that. And just to hear his stories about being pulled over by the police and what it feels like to be in a shop and have eyes on you, right? And I teach a class at a local college, an ethics class, and most of my students are African-American. And they write essays. They talk about, you know, being 17 years old in this progressive city that I'm in, supposed to be progressive, and they still get those looks from the store clerks and all that, right? So it's conversations like that, I think, that have opened me up to be able to think and talk and write in these terms. And I think absent those kind of relationships, it's hard to, it's like telling people about Jesus, right? It's really hard to have that conversation over a tweet or Facebook page. No one gets converted. No one gets has a meaningful change in their perspective with that stuff. So it really has to be personal. And I know that that's not grand enough. That's not like systemic. That's not the Civil Rights Act 1964. Like it's you know, or the Voting Rights Act. But I do think that's the level at which people actually change is on that human community relational level.
Well, and I think, you know, living as I do here in the Twin Cities, especially in the aftermath of George Floyd, I think, you know, the Twin Cities has had to do a lot of, in the last year and a half, a lot of soul searching. I think for a lot of white people, was in some ways eye-opening that things that this was not like Lake Wobegon. You know, things were not wonderful. But I think we're all trying to figure out, you know, do we have to do something big to change everything? And it's kind of like, no, I think what you do is you get to know someone and you talk about things and talk about life, and those stories will come and bubble up. And I think you're right. That's what's going to change things. It's, you know, yes, there are times where you have to have marches and sit-ins or things like that. But most of the time, it's people coming together to share their lives with each other. I mean, most of what Jesus' ministry was basically being in relationship with other people. That's what happened. It wasn't, you know, he was, you know, doing something in some big stadium somewhere. It was just meeting people.
No, absolutely. And if I'll put my Methodist hat on for a minute, there are historians that argue that the reason France had a bloody, violent revolution and Great Britain did not is because the Methodist movement had so uplifted the poor in Great Britain that there just wasn't the interest or desire or that sort of, you know, mass of angry, impoverished people to do that. And Methodism transformed Britain, not so much through at the level of legislation or the level of sort of grand things. The Methodist movement, the engine of it was relational, small groups, three to five people, 10 to 12 people, society meetings where people confess their sin, held each other accountable in love, follow Jesus together. And a lot of that uplifted the poor, that, you know, built schools for poor kids and all that. But it happened at a very micro level but it had very large consequences for society writ large. I think we often, that doesn't sound big enough to people. And not to say there's not things that, that could be done, for sure. I read last year, I think, New Jim Crow. And that was a very eye-opening book. That was a very, difficult book, but also very well-researched and significant book for me. But I do think for people's perspective, we've learned this with the abortion debate, I think, that changing legislation does not change people's hearts and minds. And I don't think that we're going to come to a better understanding of the history of, racism and its implications today with legislation, even though there's some that may be helpful. It needs to happen at a level of people.
Yeah, I think, the way that the kind of racial progress has happened is, I think in the 50s and 60s, what was happening was dismantling the legal framework, the laws that were in place and all of that. What's happened in the 50 years since, is more dismantling kind of the social framework. And that takes a lot longer because it's not as visible. It's easy to take down a whites only sign or to something like that, or integrate a school. Well, it's not that easy, but it's done. But it's harder to start to really deal with some of the biases or misunderstandings or things that have been there for decades. And I think that takes time.
Yeah, for sure. I'll name a resource that I found helpful that could be a model for what we're describing. It was one that I listened to, I think, last year. The author's name is escaping me. It was called Be the Bridge. I thought it was maybe the best book I've read that tries to approach racial reconciliation, racial justice from a Christian lens. A lot of what's out there is from a secular perspective. There's value to those too. This was from what I would consider a pretty robust theological frame. And that's one. And it's got discussion questions and stuff for church discussions and discussions between an Anglo and a Black church and things like that. That I thought was actually a pretty helpful resource on this for what we're talking about.
One question that I have is, and you kind of touched it briefly in the essay, is what do you think was the role of John Wesley when it came to the issue of race during his own lifetime and then after that? Because obviously he spoke a lot or had, as the statement that you had about American slavery, he had some role in dealing with the end of the slave trade, at least with Britain. What do you think has been his role?
Yeah, he certainly was supporting Wilberforce and wanting to see it outlawed in the UK. My history is not good enough to tell you how involved he was in that. I want to say that maybe that was a fairly new discussion near the end of Wesley's life, so I don't know how involved he'd been beyond encouraging Wilberforce. The timeline is not there for me in my head right now. Did you ever see the movie Amazing Grace about Wilberforce?
I have not. I need to see that.
It's a good kind of church group movie. Okay. The guy that played Mr. Fantastic in the terrible Fox Fantastic Four movies plays Wilberforce. Okay. But it was pretty good. And it features John Newton in there, of course, who, had been a slave owner, had an evangelical conversion, wrote Amazing Grace. He's got a neat part in that movie. But that's a powerful, powerful movie. I mean, the early Methodist movement was anti-slavery. I'm listening right now to, this book is so long, it's Ron Chernow's new biography of Washington. It's very good. It's long. It's extensive. But one of the anecdotes in the book is when the two original American Methodist bishops, Asbury and Cope, they actually visited Washington's house because they were putting forth a piece of legislation in Virginia to end slavery, and they wanted Washington's support. Of course, Washington hemmed and hawed on that. He didn't put his name to it explicitly. He was sort of on both sides of the fence about slavery in his life, from what I understand from that book. But that to say early Methodism was explicitly anti-slavery, but much like the story of kind of America itself, very quickly for the sake of unity, kind of gave up on that stance so that the Methodist movement could grow in America and all that. So we started off kind of in a place where like the Quakers were, but compromised on that pretty early on, unfortunately. Again, in the American context.
So I think the final question that I have is, what do you think is your objective with this essay? What do you think is you want someone to get from reading this essay?
I would want someone that has been, let's say, a supporter of Black Lives Matter, who's a Christian, to walk away thinking that they have a more robust theological frame for making that affirmation. That it's not, they're not just saying that because they're a good liberal. They're not just saying that because they're a good person, but that there is significant theological and biblical warrant for saying it, for how God works in history, how God works in scripture, the arc of salvation history, all those things. I would want someone that's maybe not been as quick to affirm Black Lives Matter, who's a Christian, to think more carefully about that, the reasons for rejecting that. And hopefully, I've given them hopefully some good reasons to think maybe differently about it, both about why it's something that we can and should affirm from a Christian perspective, and why it's worth rethinking. And I think why our African-American neighbors need to hear the church say this, maybe. I don't want to speak for anyone, especially for African-Americans, but again, I think, silence is violence is sort of a trope, and it's a little silly to me. But there is something to... The church needs to have a moral voice, and I don't think that should be an ideological voice. You and I have had conversations along these lines previously. So maybe that's part of it, is that for the Christians that have resisted this language, to see it not as a political or ideological statement, but to see it as a statement of God's grace for all of humanity, in particular for African-American sisters and brothers who at least we should be willing to hear them say, we feel like, based on not just hundreds of years of history, but the last 10 years of history and all these horrible things, that society does not care what happens to us. And as the church, we should be able to the first people to say, for us, because we love Jesus, your life matters to us.
I think that is a great place to end it. The essay is The Scandal of Particularity, Black Lives and Jesus, which is in Firebrand Magazine. And there will be a link in the show notes. And Drew, it's been good to talk to you, to have this discussion. I hope that we can have this discussion again sometime soon on another topic.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun, Dennis. It's nice to connect via Zoom face-to-face. Thanks for the chance to talk about this piece. And I'd welcome your listeners to reach out with questions or comments. I part of writing this is I want to learn. And I want to learn from folks that like it and folks that don't like it. So I'd love to hear from folks. Shoot me an email. You can leave a link to my Twitter or whatever. I'm not hard to find on the interwebs. But thanks for the chance just to talk and for your insights as well.
All right. Take care.
Yeah.